We have been reporting on Russia's military buildup on the eastern border of Ukraine, and that has raised fears of a possible invasion. And for weeks, talks between Ukraine's Western allies and Moscow have appeared stalled.
Russia wants NATO to agree that it will never allow Ukraine to join the military alliance. It's a hard line that President Putin is unwilling to budge on, and that has some experts questioning whether the Russian president is actually interested in negotiating with the West at all.
But our next guest says this conflict over Ukraine's place in NATO didn't start with Putin. Russia has been warning about an expanding NATO for decades, and he argues that the U.S. has not worked for a peaceful solution to the impasse over Ukraine. Let's talk now to Anatol Levin, Senior Research Fellow on Russia and Europe at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Welcome.
Hello.
You write that Russia has been warning about NATO's moves to the east, going back to Boris Yeltsin in the 90s. What is the narrative here?
Well, what I think this demonstrates is that opposition to NATO expansion is not just about Vladimir Putin, and it's not about his domestic agendas. It is, in fact, rooted in what the Russian establishment and a great many ordinary Russians see as vital Russian national interests and threats to those interests. Remember that the Yeltsin government was, you know, considered very pro-Western, probably the most pro-Western government you can ever imagine Russia having. But it was some of the liberals themselves, like Andrei Kozyrev, Yeltsin's foreign minister, who precisely warned that the expansion of NATO would turn Russia as a whole against the West and would damage pro-Western liberalism within Russia. And of course, that is pretty much what has happened. Now, in particular, from the very first days of NATO expansion or the discussion of it, Russians of all political stripes warned that because of a whole set of specific issues involving Ukraine and Georgia, to bring them into NATO would inevitably bring about confrontation between Russia and the West and a very strong risk of war.
Yeah. And so just to make sure I stay with you, are you saying that, you know, since the 90s, when East Germany became part of a unified Germany and other NATO countries further to the east began joining NATO, these warnings were coming and they were particularly loud when it came to Georgia and Ukraine?
That is exactly correct. They were very loud, they were continuous, and they were not listened to.
Okay. And when you talk about Russian national interests, you mentioned if you speak to Russian elites or the regular person in Russia, they would think about a threat to Russian national interests with this creeping eastward of NATO. What are those national interests?
Well, the first should be completely understandable to any American. It is Russia's version of the Monroe Doctrine. Indeed, Russia often refers to the Monroe Doctrine. In other words, no country is going to welcome the appearance in its immediate neighborhood of a potentially hostile military alliance with, at its core, a hostile great power. You know, that has been the most continuous and deeply held principle of American foreign policy for the past 200 years as regards Central America. Russia is no different. But there are a couple of other issues involved which really reflect the fact that we in the West talk about the Soviet Union as an empire and its collapse as the collapse of an empire, but we haven't thought through what that means in comparative terms. Every empire that has collapsed over the past 100 years or hundreds of years has left in its wake large numbers of ethnic conflicts, battles over territory, battles over national identity. That was true of the Turkish Empire in the Middle East, true of the British, the French, all of them, basically. And it was the same with the Soviet Union. Obviously, NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine implies NATO support against Russia in those conflicts and disputes, which quite obviously raises the possibility of war. In the case of Ukraine, of course, this also involved the specific issue of the status of Russian minorities within Ukraine, and of the great Russian naval base at Sevastopol in Crimea, because Crimea has now been annexed by Russia. But until 2014, it was absolutely clear if Ukraine joins NATO, Ukraine will demand, with NATO backing, that Russia abandons Sevastopol. I mean, in terms both of strategic importance and emotional importance, it's pretty much like America asking America to abandon Pearl Harbor and the Alamo simultaneously. Wait till that day happens, and America will develop a certain empathy with Russian feelings.
Now, you have written of some potential ways to diffuse this situation, and I want to ask you about it. One thing that some have thrown out is potentially a moratorium on Ukraine joining NATO. Is that a feasible possibility here?
Well, I think it's a feasible possibility, and others, including Tom Graham, former senior U.S. diplomat, have said the same. Because the West, by this, actually sacrifices nothing. Nobody thinks that Ukraine is going to join NATO in the next 10 years or 20 years, or, for that matter, as long as the conflicts with Russia continue, because, of course, NATO is absolutely determined not to fight Russia. So, on the one hand, agreeing to a moratorium sacrifices nothing on behalf of the West, but, of course, it avoids the humiliating climb down that would be involved if we actually declared that we simply acceded to Russian demands and declared that Ukraine will never join NATO. That is probably politically completely impossible for the West. But a moratorium is not, if we are indeed interested in some kind of reasonable compromise.
Well, and finally, I guess I want to get your sense of what might be realistic at this moment with this number of Russian troops on the border. Do you think there is still realistically time and political space right now to pursue some of these negotiations, some of these potential off-ramps to violence?
Well, yes, because obviously the Russians have not attacked yet. They have not yet put in place the additional troops that would be necessary for them to invade successfully. So clearly, Moscow is still interested in a negotiated settlement. Now, of course, they want a negotiated settlement which meets some of their key concerns. But obviously, they are still prepared to compromise, or we would have seen invasion already, frankly. But the other thing is that for 6 years, the West did nothing to try to promote a peaceful settlement over Ukraine. We agreed to Minsk too, but we did nothing, actually to bring it about. So it would seem that the existing negotiations are only taking place because Russia has threatened military action. So saying that we can't negotiate, in the face of military pressure is the same as saying we will never negotiate because we never did in the past.
Yeah.
This is indeed the right moment to try to negotiate a compromise. But a compromise means a compromise. There have to be certain concessions on the Western side as well, obviously, as on the Russian side. As I've said, we cannot possibly agree to all the Russian demands as they stand. But on the other hand, I am very afraid that if, as our present position suggests, or at least the present American position suggests, we do not seriously try at all for a compromise agreement with Russia, then the possibility of war is very strong.
Anatole Levin is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thanks so much for taking the time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.